Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 61. What, me Claudius? I feel like I could pitch the story of Claudius to studio executives and get them to invest in my slapstick period comedy about the bumbling, stuttering black sheep of the family who, when his crazy nephew is assassinated and no other viable candidates can be found, suddenly finds himself proclaimed emperor of the Roman Empire. Of course, our sympathetic hero is not really the idiot everyone thinks he is. He's just misunderstood. And as he navigates his way through the treacherous and often hilarious world of Roman power politics, from the heart of the capital to the far-off island of Britain, he emerges as a just, wise, but still physically clumsy ruler trying to do right in a world gone horribly and hilariously wrong. Starring Ricky Gervais as Claudius and Rowan Atkinson as the freedman's secretary Narcissus, trying in vain to hold everything together. Co-starring Britton Jermaine from Flight of the Conchords as the brothers who lead the resistance to Claudius's invasion of Britain, and of course, Leslie Nielsen will get a cameo as the ghost of Caesar Augustus. This, my friends, is pure comedy gold. And the thing is, I wouldn't have to stray too far from the historical record to write the script. Maybe add a few more pratfalls, but other than that, the true story of Claudius's improbable rise to power looks and feels enough like the premise of a comedy that we wouldn't have to touch the underlying story at all. It's a weird thing that Claudius became emperor. Weirder still, that he turned out to be a good one. Tiberius Claudius Drusus was born in 10 BC in Gaul, the youngest of the three surviving children of Drusus and Antonia. His older brother was the great Germanicus, and his older sister was the cunning Livilla. From the start, though, young Claudius was neither great nor cunning. In fact, for his entire childhood, there are zero examples of anything resembling a positive adjective being attached to his name. Young Claudius, it seems, suffered from some sort of nervous tic that led to a pronounced stutter throughout his youth, which earned him nothing but scorn and exasperation from the extended imperial family. Theories abound about what his affliction actually was, ranging from cerebral palsy to polio to Tourette's, but nobody knows for sure what it was. What we do know is that his mother Antonia appears to have been horrified by him and showed nothing but disdain for her youngest son. When not referring to him as a monster, she used him as the benchmark for stupidity, as in, "Why, that man is as dumb as my son Claudius." Unable, I guess, to even stand the sight of him, Antonia dumped Claudius off on Livia, who herself had nothing but contempt for this stuttering embarrassment of a boy. Livia had no time to deal with him, so she hired a, quote, tutor to look after him. The tutor, who legend holds was a former mule driver, used severe discipline to try to break Claudius of his witless ways, which everyone assumed was simply caused by laziness and bad moral fiber. Claudius survived his childhood, and when he emerged into his teens, he showed some signs that he was not actually an idiot, just that he had difficulty communicating his ideas to other people verbally. He expressed an interest in studying history, and encouraged that there may be hope for the little monster after all, Augustus hired Livy to tutor his step-grandson in 7 AD. This opened up a brief window of time during which Claudius appears to have climbed out of the family doghouse. In a letter to Livia, Augustus even expressed amazement after hearing Claudius deliver a fine oration that the young man was even capable of such a thing. Apparently finding the formal rules of oratory to be some kind of mental crutch, Claudius turned out to be quite a capable public speaker. It was only in private conversation that his mouth kept hiccuping on him. This brief spell of acceptance was broken when Claudius decided to write a history of the civil wars. The finished draft was read by Livia, who deemed the work far too critical, read, accurate, a telling of Augustus's rise to power. The work was suppressed, and the family henceforth decided that Claudius could not be trusted with the family secrets and must never be allowed anywhere near power. After Augustus died, 23-year-old Claudius petitioned Tiberius to allow him to enter the cursus honorum, but Tiberius refused his nephew's request. Claudius was not to be allowed a public career. He would have to settle for a private life of scholarship. Throughout the 20s AD, Claudius tried to stay below the radar as Sejanus rose to power and targeted anyone he thought might be a threat. It is a testament to how insignificant a political figure Claudius was at this point that he survived the purges and counter-purges of Sejanus and Tiberius, even as they swallowed his brother, sister, and various nephews, nieces, and cousins. The small role Claudius did play in the drama of Tiberius's reign was as a husband of convenience for Sejanus, who married his adopted sister to the imperial family's black sheep in order to strengthen his own ties to the ruling clan. The marriage ended in a quick divorce after Sejanus fell from power, and Claudius couldn't afford any connections to the disgraced and executed former prefect of the guard. Over the course of Tiberius's reign, as politically insignificant as he was, Claudius did make a respectable name for himself as an author and a scholar. After getting burned early for writing about topics that hit too close to home, Claudius branched out and wrote a history of the Etruscans and later produced an 8-volume series on the Carthaginians. So while he got no love from his family, the wider Roman world seems to have grown well disposed towards the one member of the imperial family who didn't seem to be lusting after power. When Augustus died, the upper class equestrians actually chose Claudius to head their delegation during the funeral procession, and during Tiberius's reign, the Senate voted to allow Claudius the right to join in the body's debates, though this latter bill was vetoed by the emperor. After Tiberius's son Drusus died, Claudius was even championed as a possible new heir apparent, though Claudius hastily and smartly declared that he had no interest in the job. After Tiberius died and Caligula became emperor, Claudius suddenly found himself thrust into the public career he had long since given up on. Upon his ascension, Caligula decided to serve as consul and chose, of all people, Claudius to serve as his colleague. This was not out of any great love or respect for Uncle Claudius, though. Mostly, Caligula just wanted to remind people of Germanicus and so elevated his dead father's brother to the consulship. Far from respect, Caligula actually seems to have gone out of his way to torture his uncle, turning Claudius into a sort of de facto court jester, kept around mostly to be the butt of the emperor's jokes. But it wasn't all just, ha-ha, I put a whoopee cushion on Claudius's chair kind of jokes. Caligula also extorted huge sums of money from his uncle, at one point inventing a new priesthood and then forcing Claudius and a few other wealthy targets to pony up ridiculous fees to join. Non-compliance would have surely meant death, and by the time Caligula's short reign was over, this and other events like it caused Claudius to be deep in debt. Legend has it that when Caligula was assassinated, Claudius was found hiding behind a curtain in the imperial palace. Quite reasonably assuming that he was about to be killed, Claudius was shocked when the members of the guard who found him knelt and proclaimed him emperor. That's the legend, anyway. Other, probably more reliable accounts have Claudius being hustled back to the Praetorian camp, unsure of his fate, only later being proclaimed emperor. I said last week that this happened on the night of the assassination, but alert listener Claude was kind enough to remind me that Gibbon says that at least 48 hours passed before Claudius was declared emperor. During the interval, the Senate argued with itself over who should be the next princeps, but when they were unable to unify behind a single candidate, the Praetorians seized the initiative and called it for Claudius, who they hoped to be able to control. It speaks volumes about how entrenched the new imperial system had become that when the Senate found itself briefly without an emperor lording over them, they dissolved into arguments not about how best to reassert the Senate's authority, but rather who among them should rule. The bickering in the Senate was finally shut down when word came that the Praetorian Guard had in fact settled the matter and named Uncle Claudius Princeps. Too factionalized to resist, the Senate found itself accepting the Guard's decision. Foolish, clumsy, embarrassing Claudius was now the absolute ruler of the Roman Empire. But the Senate still had some pull, and they extracted a promise that Claudius would not prosecute Caligula's assassins or anyone who may have been involved in the wider conspiracy, which a number of the senators were. Claudius agreed, but he refused to spare the lead assassin, Caria, who was eventually tried and convicted for the murder of Caligula. Yes, it was a very good thing that Caligula was dead, but it would set a very bad precedent for there to be no punishment whatsoever for the high crime of assassinating an emperor. Not that anyone paid attention to the message Claudius was trying to send, as he spent most of his reign dodging murderous plots of every shape and size, and in the end was very likely done in by one hatched by his wife Agrippina. It appears that while everyone outwardly accepted Claudius, behind every back was a knife, or a bottle of poison, or the legion stationed in Dalmatia. On that last point, Claudius was wise to make one of his first moves after taking office be the payment of cash bribes to the army to ensure their loyalty, Because in 42, a plot was cooked up between an ambitious senator in Rome and the governor of Dalmatia, who just so happened to be an ex-brother-in-law of Claudius. Their plan was relatively simple. The governor was going to march his legions on Rome and then depose Claudius. The only problem was that when it came time to actually launch the rebellion, the troops decided that they were better off staying put rather than joining in a dangerous scheme to take control of the empire. The planned coup fell apart, and the governor, publicly exposed, committed suicide. So, while Claudius did his best to maintain good relations with the Senate and anyone else who might conceivably want him dead, it got him nowhere. With his reputation as a bumbling fool, everyone seems to have thought that killing Claudius would not only be easy, but that it was necessary for the good of the empire. After all, how long could Rome last with an idiot in charge? But the thing is, Claudius wasn't an idiot, and far from running the empire into the ground, or doing what everybody thought he was going to do, which was like embarrass Rome at parties, Claudius proved to be one of the more capable emperors Rome ever saw. He took an active interest in governance, which is something Rome had not really seen since Augustus had died 25 years earlier. He further strengthened the imperial bureaucracy, ordered targeted reforms be made to the legal system, and every day issued dozens of edicts on a wide range of topics. Rome, in short, had a competent executive again. But the Romans weren't quite ready to accept the notion that Claudius actually knew what he was doing, and most attributed anything halfway intelligent that came out of the imperial palace to be from one of his various freedmen advisors, who were said to have the pliable emperor completely under their thumb. The extent to which Claudius relied on his advisors is probably exaggerated, but there is no denying that the power and influence of freedmen bureaucrats did rise precipitously during the reign of Rome's fourth emperor. It should be noted, though, that the growing power of the bureaucracy was more of a reaction to circumstance than anything Claudius was actively planning to do from the start. Like his predecessors, Claudius had a difficult time getting the Senate to help share in the burdens of government, so he was forced to do everything for himself. But unlike his predecessors, except for Augustus, he actually had an interest in getting things done. So he reorganized the state to make it more responsive and efficient. He created the equivalent of a governmental cabinet and appointed capable freedmen to head the new departments he created. There was a secretary of correspondence, the aforementioned Narcissus, who was probably the closest to Claudius and the most influential, a secretary of justice, Gaius Julius Callistus, who had been an important cog in the plot to kill Caligula, a secretary of the treasury, Marcus Antonius Pallas, who was said to have grown richer than even Crassus by the time of his death, and a secretary of miscellany, Gaius Iulius Polybius, who would eventually be executed for plotting against the emperor. These men acted as the eyes, ears, mouths, and brains of Claudius's administration, and were instrumental in making his reign a successful one. Pallas, for example, apparently did such a good job nursing the empire's finances back to health after Caligula wrecked everything that the Senate voted him a big fancy award. In most respects, Claudius did his best to emulate Augustus, and he tried mightily to associate himself with the original princeps. Ascending to the throne, he added the name Caesar and Augustus to his own, and even revived the long-forgotten rumor that his father Drusus was actually the son of Augustus rather than Tiberius Claudius Nero. For the most part, Claudius did a pretty good job copying Augustus, from the stable and patient public administration right down to the hectic and distracting personal life, which we'll get more into next week. But to really establish himself as an emperor worthy of the same respect that Augustus had enjoyed, Claudius would have to stray from Augustus's injunction not to expand the empire. Because if he was ever going to be taken seriously, Claudius needed some impressive military victories to go with his bland legal reforms. After surveying the map, it quickly became obvious that the only territory ripe for conquest was the far-flung island of Britannia. The double bonus Britannia offered Claudius image-wise was that he would be following in the footsteps of the great Julius Caesar, who had tried unsuccessfully to bring the island into the Roman fold 100 years before. If Claudius could succeed where Caesar had, in essence, failed, well, that would be a pretty big feather in the new emperor's cap. But it wasn't just about optics and glory. Britannia was also rich with mineral deposits that the Romans had long coveted, and the island was becoming a safe haven for rebellious Gauls who were forever making trouble for Roman administrators in the north. So Claudius looked at Britain and saw an opportunity to A, do what Julius Caesar couldn't do, B, make the empire richer, and C, make the empire safer. Invasion plans were drawn up immediately. The excuse Claudius needed to invade came in 43, when the king of a Roman allied tribe on the island was ousted from power by an expanding rival tribe. Claudius ordered Aulus Plautius to lead 4 legions across the English Channel and punish the tribes who had messed with a Roman ally. Probably regathering the same legions that had been raised by Caligula just a few years before, Plautius massed his invasion force, which, in addition to the 4 legions, included some 20,000 auxiliaries, on the north coast of Gaul. But as they prepared to sail, a mutiny broke out when the men realized that this time around, they weren't just going to be picking up seashells for the emperor. Terrified of what lay on the uncivilized island that, in addition to being populated with monsters, was practically falling off the edge of the world, the men refused to budge. Narcissus, who had been sent to keep an eye on things for Claudius, managed to get things back on track by addressing the men and reminding them of their duty. Apparently, it wasn't his words that actually worked on him. They were just tickled by the spectacle of this former slave addressing them as if he was their leader, as it reminded them of the traditional role-switching games that are played during Saturnalia. The troops agreed to stand down their mutiny. Now, the only really good account we have of the invasion comes from Cassius Dio, who was writing 150 years after the fact, so no one is really sure exactly what happened next. Even simple things like where the fleet took off from and where they landed are in dispute, and it seems like every historian has their own pet theory about whether the Romans landed in Kent, as the traditional accounting goes, or whether it was down by the Isle of Wight, and whether they came in 3 equal divisions or just one big one, or one big one with 2 smaller detachments. I am not going to get bogged down with these controversies, so I'm just going to say that the Romans were in Gaul, then they got on some transport ships, then they were in Britain. Whatever route they took, and wherever they landed, the Roman invasion of Britain had begun. Now, the locals weren't just going to stand by while their land was conquered by these foreign invaders. 2 brothers, named Tugadumnus and Caraticus, who led the tribe that had ousted the Roman allied king in the first place, gathered up a resistance force and set themselves on the banks of the River Medway to prevent the Romans from penetrating into the interior of the island. But as was so often the case, when it came to set-piece battles, the Romans were second to none. Not that they had an easy go of it. The battle that was fought beside the Medway allegedly lasted for 2 days. Just that, in the end, as usual, the Romans simply wore their opponents out. The British were forced to retreat to the Thames. The Romans pursued, and a second battle was fought alongside that river, with the Romans again winning. Having secured a safe crossing point on the Thames, which appears to have been the initial strategic goal of the invasion, Plautius sent word to Claudius to join him so the emperor could get in on the action before it was too late. Arriving with reinforcements, including 16 war elephants, Claudius met up with Plautius, and together they pushed into the home tribal territory of Tugadumnus and Caraticus, though at some point between the battle on the Thames and the final surrender, Tugadumnus appears to have died. Though Caraticus refused to give up, 11 other local kings decided further resistance was suicidal and surrendered en masse to Claudius. Southeast Britain was now in Roman hands, and the occupying force set up a base of operations in a site that they named, and there's no way I'm pronouncing this correctly, Camulodunum, which is today the site of Colchester in Essex County. There is a map of all this posted on this week's episode, so be sure to go to thehistoryofrome.typepad.com and download that. Staying just long enough to bask in the glow of victory, Claudius returned to Rome and celebrated a triumph. While he certainly did more than Caligula had done to earn his triumph, Claudius was no military man and didn't really contribute anything to the victory. It would be a few years yet before Rome would see another emperor who had a respectable military record, as Nero would prove as inept as his immediate predecessors at military affairs. In fact, the man who will emerge from the chaos of 69 AD was actually building his respectable military record in Britain as we speak. The future Emperor Vespasian commanded one of the invading legions, and after the Romans set up a base in Essex, he led his army west all the way to Exeter, extending Roman control over the southern coast of Britain. Another force was sent north, and within 4 years of arriving, the Romans were firmly in command of roughly the territory southeast of an imaginary line you draw between the Severn and Humber estuaries. It's all on the map. With his reforms of the state bureaucracy paying off, and his quest to add a valuable new province to the empire's success, Claudius was off and running. Next week, though, we'll get into the one area where Claudius really was a complete disaster, his personal life. Married a total of 4 times, Claudius was always struggling with the women in his life. The wife he came into office with actually wound up secretly marrying another man behind Claudius's back, so he had to dump her, and then he wound up married to his niece, and she probably killed him. All through his marital problems, Claudius was forced to fend off constant assassination plots, leading him to try and execute more than 300 equestrians and senators during his years in power. It is amazing he managed to last as long as he did. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, Episode 62, Take My Wife, Please. In the uncertain days after the assassination of Caligula, the people of Rome must have wondered whether or not they had now actually seen the worst the imperial dynasty could throw at them. They had, after all, thought the worst was behind them once before, after Tiberius, who had spent the last half of his reign as a paranoid recluse. But everyone soon realized that Caligula was a debauched madman who just took everything that made Tiberius's final years unbearable and times them by 10. So when Caligula was murdered, it is understandable that the Romans were a bit gun-shy about their next emperor. As the saying goes, fool me once, shame on you, fool me, we can't get fooled again. So they held their collective breath as they waited for word from the Senate to come about who would be the empire's next princeps. It can't possibly be worse than Caligula, can it? When word came that it would be Claudius, yes, Uncle Claudius, they must have let go their breath with a deflated sigh. How interesting, it actually can get worse. We went from a cruel old pervert to a raving madman, and now we are left with nothing more than a blubbering idiot. Truly, we have combed the far reaches of our mighty empire and drawn from the ranks of our citizen body the finest and most able men to rule over us. Uncle Claudius, sweet Jupiter, let's go get a drink. But once they had turned their backs in disgust, a funny thing happened. Claudius turned out to be not so bad. Pretty good, even. Did you hear that the campaigns in Britain are going well? That Claudius has successfully established a whole new province? Have you seen the new roads? They're not half bad. I was in court the other day, and Claudius not only presided over cases, but his judgments were measured and reasonable. I even saw him ignore the prescribed penalties after a man had been found guilty because, because justice demanded it. I know, justice. Damnedest thing I've ever seen. They always said Claudius was a stuttering fool, and that may well be, but Emperor Claudius seems like a pretty good egg. I should pause here for a second and address something that popped up in the comment thread last week. Veronica was wondering if she had missed the part where suddenly the Romans switched and began referring to their rulers as emperors rather than princeps, as Augustus had preferred. The answer is that, well, no, technically you didn't miss that part. The title emperor is used commonly by historians to label the rulers of the Roman Empire after the ascent of Augustus, but the Romans themselves used a number of different titles for the man at the top, including princeps, Augustus, and simply Caesar. The technical meaning of imperator still carried with it a martial connotation, and, in fact, when Claudius ascended to the throne, he refused the imperator honorific because he had done nothing to earn it. Not that he didn't want it, just that he felt a little awkward being hailed as a great commander when the closest he had ever gotten to a battle was reading about it in a book. Part of the rationale behind the invasion of Britain was to earn the street cred he would need to actually accept the title. After Claudius, the honorific imperator was accepted and not accepted, or more accurately, granted and not granted, depending on the man in question. But eventually, the title did simply become hereditary, and thus we have come to refer to the whole lot of them as emperor, regardless of whether or not they had technically been awarded the title imperator or not. The reality of how power was consolidated and legitimized during this period is far more complicated than a man simply becoming emperor the way a man becomes a king. But the effect wound up being basically the same, so historians shorthand the whole convoluted mess into a single title, and that title is emperor. So, following convention, I have found myself calling these men emperors, even though the Romans themselves did not use the word the same way we do. I would say that it falls under the category of generally accepted principles and practices, not technically accurate, but acceptably descriptive enough for auditing purposes. So we left off last week with Claudius overseeing the successful conclusion of what would prove to be merely the first phase of the Roman invasion of Britain. General Plautius had become Governor Plautius, and he set about quickly and efficiently absorbing the conquered portions of southeast Britannia into the empire. Usually there was a waiting period after a territory is targeted for integration by the Romans, during which a local client monarch rules as an ally of Rome, but there was no beating around the bush in Britain. As soon as the Romans had a foothold, they began direct administration. Not that that foothold was at times anything more than a foothold, mind you. It would take until the end of the century before the rest of the island was pacified in any meaningful way, and even then, their dominance only extended so far north. The Emperor Hadrian finally decided to simply build a wall rather than make a play at conquering the truly crazy barbarians up in the highlands of the far north. There's a funny line I heard about that once that I've always remembered, even though I have no idea who said it, that went something like, Hadrian decided to build his wall so the Scots would be left undisturbed in their never-ending war against their mortal enemies, the Scots. Which I think sums up the whole situation nicely. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Plautius remained as governor until 47 and spent the majority of his time and energy consolidating the Roman position, building veteran settlements, and getting the locals to fall in line with his new tax policies. When Plautius was replaced by Ostorius Scapula, though, the new governor decided to push west into Wales. The fugitive British leader Caratacus had fallen back to the defensible western quarter of the island and was using it as a base to run a guerrilla insurrection against the Roman occupation. He spent years harassing and confounding the Romans until he was finally drawn into a set battle in 50 AD. Though the king set himself up as best he could, taking the high ground and building a decent string of fortifications, the Romans were able to penetrate the defenses and, once inside the British line, cut through the locals with ruthless efficiency. The Romans captured Caratacus's wife and brothers, but the chief himself managed to slip away. He fled north and tried to take refuge with a neighboring tribe, but the Roman allied queen of the territory immediately handed Caratacus over to the Romans as a show of loyalty to the new foreign overlords. With that, the most prominent and able leader of the British resistance was whisked off the island and taken back to Rome, where he was paraded around as a prized treasure. But unlike, say, Vercingetorix, who rotted away in a cell for years until Caesar found the time to have him strangled, Caratacus was dealt with immediately, and, surprisingly, after impressing the Romans with the utterly unrepentant way that he carried himself, they let him live. He had requested and received an audience with the Senate, and when he stood before them, he gave a memorable speech that wound up saving his life. He said, "I had horses, men, arms, and wealth. What wonder if I was unwilling to lose them? If you wish to command everyone, does it really follow that everyone should accept your slavery? If I were now being handed over as one who had surrendered immediately, neither my fortune nor your glory would have achieved brilliance." Then he asked them point blank to spare his life so that he could remain an eternal symbol of Rome's clemency. Really, it was a savvy bit of work for a man facing almost certain execution, and the audacity of the whole spectacle impressed Claudius, and the emperor spared the British king's life, allowing him to set up a nice little farm in Italy to live out the rest of his days. Before he passes from our narrative, I will let Caratacus have one final word. Touring Rome, he was impressed with the splendor of the great capital, and remarked, "And can you then, who have such possessions, and so many of them, covet our poor tents?" Which, I think, is a question worth asking. With his success in policy and in war, Claudius was cementing a reputation for overseeing a pretty competent administration. Like I said last week, though, more than a few Romans were unwilling to believe that Claudius was really calling the shots, so running parallel and in opposition to this reputation for running a pretty good ship was a reputation for having a pretty good ship run him. And it wasn't just his freedmen who were said to pilot Claudius around. It was also his various wives. Claudius never had the best luck with women. His obvious physical defects made marrying him quite a bit more difficult than finding a suitable mate for his brother or sister. The first time the imperial family found somebody to say yes to an engagement, the match was soon after broken off for political reasons. His next fiancée lasted all the way to the altar, but then died on their wedding day. So, for Claudius, that would be 0 for 2. His third marriage attempt finally took, and he was paired with a woman named Plautia Erga Lanilla, the daughter of a friend of Livia's. Basically, the Augusta was owed a favor, and she cashed it in. The union produced Claudius's first child, a son named Claudius Drusus, who tragically died of asphyxiation when he was just entering his teens. The marriage was destined for a similar fate, and in 24 AD, Erga Lanilla was not only accused of adultery, but also that she had conspired to murder her sister-in-law. After their divorce was finalized, Erga Lanilla gave birth to a second child, a daughter named Claudia, who Claudius repudiated, as it was widely known that he was not even the father. So far, not so good. A bachelor once more, Claudius was targeted by Sejanus as the perfect match for the prefect's adopted sister, Paetina. Floating like a leaf down the tumultuous river of Roman politics, Claudius no doubt saw the value in being related to the ruthlessly ambitious Sejanus as the prefect's star was rising. So Claudius allowed himself to be used as a conduit for Sejanus's entry into the Julio-Claudian family, and he married Paetina in 28 AD. Once Sejanus fell, though, Claudius couldn't afford any connections to the disgraced prefect, and he divorced his wife. While those around him drowned, Claudius continued to float downriver. His next marriage came after Caligula ascended to the throne. Whether by luck or design, Claudius paired up with a regular and influential member of the young emperor's court, a woman named Valeria Messalina. Messalina was an ambitious woman, and while it sure seems to be the case that nobody really wanted to marry Claudius, Messalina was pretty excited to at least be marrying the uncle of the emperor. That uncle was, well, Claudius, was no great problem. Messalina wasn't planning on being tied down, if you know what I mean. The match worked out well for both of them for a time. Messalina was married into the imperial family, and Claudius now had an additional layer of protection to get him through the crazy years of Caligula's reign. Messalina fit right in with Caligula's court and had some influence over the emperor, so, because Messalina needed Claudius to cement her ties with the family, she would always be a fierce advocate within Caligula's inner circle to not execute Claudius should the whim to do so crop up, which reportedly it did on more than one occasion. Together, if usually apart, Claudius and Messalina survived the random madness of Caligula, and after Claudius ascended to the throne, Messalina suddenly and surprisingly found herself empress, which was, I think, an ambition beyond her wildest dreams. She bore Claudius two children, a daughter named Claudia Octavia, who will eventually marry Nero, and a son called Britannicus, named in honor of his father's recent triumph in Britain. Now, she was not only the wife of the emperor, but also the mother of the heir apparent, Britannicus. Not since Livia had Rome seen a woman in such a powerful position, and Messalina, like Livia before her, did not hesitate to use her newfound powers. No shrinking violet, Messalina jumped right into politics, and using Claudius as her instrument, the empress usually had her way. Unfortunately, she did not whisper in the emperor's ear to turn his attention towards this neglected policy, or make him an advocate for that necessary reform. No, not anything so useful as that. The empress was an insecure woman, and well aware that Claudius was old and had a history of physical problems. If he were to die, she knew that she would lose everything just as quickly as she'd gained it. So the first and last order of business was securing her own position, and it was toward that end alone that she whispered in the emperor's ear. Luckily, the political climate of the times allowed Messalina to operate, probably with the aid of Narcissus, a sort of shadow purge mechanism to deal with men and women and children she considered a threat to her personally. There were so many real plots against Claudius's life to be dealt with that when the emperor's wife and most trusted advisor, brought some new list of names and assured him that they had discovered some new conspiracy, it did not really set off any warning bells. Consuls, ex-consuls, influential women, up-and-coming senators, academics, if Messalina thought they might cause her problems, it was exile or execution. Claudius did not ask too many questions. But it was not just Messalina's concern about Claudius' health that drove her. It was also the fact that she daily flirted with disaster by making a persistent cuckold of her husband. The ancient historians are unanimous in their judgment of the Empress. She was a vain, cruel nymphomaniac who disgraced Rome and brought nothing but shame upon herself and her husband. Messalina cheated early and often on Claudius, with men born both high and low. Her activities were widely documented and well known, but it seems that no one had the heart or the courage to tell Claudius what was going on, so he remained the one man in the empire who didn't know what his wife was up to. In addition to her regular liaisons with senators and actors, poets, slaves, and soldiers, there is a famous story of her competition with a well-known prostitute to see which of them could sleep with the most men in a single day. Messalina won. So the Empress needed to make sure her power had a base independent of Claudius, because who knows when her dalliances are going to finally catch up with her and trigger a divorce. Eventually, Messalina got careless or grew emboldened, if there is a difference between the two, and began to move away from simply running around behind Claudius' back. Her marriage was obviously a sham, and she knew that eventually Claudius would find out, and that would be the end of her. Plus, Germanicus' daughter Agrippina the Younger had been recalled from exile with her son Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus, the future Emperor Nero. The people had always had a soft spot in their hearts for Germanicus' family, and when she arrived, Agrippina was greeted warmly by the people. At the secular games, held in 47 AD to celebrate the 800th anniversary of the founding of Rome, Agrippina and her son received much more applause than Messalina and her son. The implication was clear. Agrippina and Lucius were full Julians, descended directly from the divine Augustus. Messalina, meanwhile, had no blood ties to the clan, and her son was merely a Claudian. Agrippina, as ambitious a woman as Rome had ever known, was clearly laying the groundwork for her son, the grandson of Germanicus, to ascend to the throne when Claudius was gone. With a ready alternative heir, perhaps even a more desirable heir standing by, Messalina could feel her leverage slipping. She was no longer as indispensable as she had once thought herself. Her solution to this problem was not to reform her ways and devote herself to Claudius and make sure that Britannicus was always the first and last name on the list of heirs. But instead, she schemed to get rid of Claudius altogether before he had a chance to turn on her. She had powerful friends, and more than enough of them wanted the Julio-Claudians expelled from power, that she decided to ditch the stuttering emperor and, with senatorial support, find a new husband and elevate him to the throne. The Julio-Claudians would be out. How exactly she thought this was going to work is sort of an open question, as in hindsight, the whole plot looks not even half-baked, but more like the mix is still sitting in a bowl on the counter. Messalina had hooked up with a consul designate named Gaius Silius, an attractive, intelligent, and well-bred man who Messalina hoped would make a fine emperor. They carried on an affair behind the backs of both of their spouses until Messalina demanded, in some sort of test of love and loyalty, that Silius divorce his wife. The senator complied and then began to exert pressure on Messalina to do the same. They were both way beyond the point of no return. Everyone knew that they were lovers and why Silius had divorced his wife, so they may as well go all in. Finally, Messalina agreed that it was time for them to make their move. They would wed first and then kill Claudius. Silius, the husband of the Empress, would step into power and everything would be super-duper. Except, what? Did they really think that they would be able to get married without the Emperor finding out about it? And that once he found out that his wife had, you know, openly left him for another man, that her position of Empress would not be compromised? The whole episode is just weirdly unthought out. Regardless, in 48, when Claudius was in Ostia overseeing a construction project, Messalina and Silius got married. and not some secret wedding where the witnesses are sworn not to reveal what they have seen and the priest is killed afterwards. No, a big, lavish ceremony. Drinks, dancing, the works, all right out in the open. Narcissus finally decided at this point that things had gone far enough. Well, way too far, actually, and resolved now to tell the truth to Claudius about his wife. Though Narcissus had formed a convenient alliance with Messalina, his first loyalty was to Claudius, and it was pretty clear that a major coup was in the works. It was time to throw Messalina under the bus. Narcissus induced two of Claudius's mistresses, yes, Claudius had mistresses, which was, different, to reveal the truth about Messalina's infidelity. Once the code of silence was broken, everyone that Claudius turned to for confirmation confirmed the stories. The emperor headed back to Rome, but before he arrived, Messalina got word that the jig was up and that her husband now knew everything. She packed up the children and headed out on the road to Ostia to intercept Claudius and hopefully talk to him alone before he turned on her completely. But as she approached the imperial procession, Narcissus, riding with Claudius, openly denounced her and forbade her from speaking with Claudius privately. Messalina tagged along as the entourage made its way back to Rome, but was never able to crack the perimeter Narcissus had set up around the emperor's carriage. Back in the city, Claudius was taken straight away to the home of Silius, which Narcissus told him he would practically be able to recognize as his own. Messalina had been transferring imperial furniture and art into the home of her lover for some time, and as soon as he walked in, Claudius knew that all the accusations were true. Messalina tried to deny everything, especially the crazy notion that she had openly married Silius. I mean, how stupid would that be? But the literally hundreds of witnesses to the ceremony were hard to argue with. Even still, Claudius, who was naturally inclined towards forgiveness, wavered over the fate of his wife. Narcissus, Pallas, and the other influential freedmen were adamant that she must be executed and that what she had done was nothing less than treason, but Claudius hesitated. The story then goes that Narcissus used the emperor's seal to send the execution order himself. A soldier knocked down Messalina's door and presented her with the warrant, giving her the option of committing suicide if she chose. But when she could not bring herself to do it, the guard stabbed her to death. Claudius was informed after the fact and is reported to have taken the news without showing much sign one way or the other that he cared, which seems a bit out of character as he seemed genuinely devoted to her, but that's what they say. Tacitus closes his chapter on the fall of Messalina with a line, "The vengeance on Messalina was just, but it had terrible consequences." There will be no episode next week, but when we return in 2 weeks, we will get into those terrible consequences. The emperor couldn't remain a bachelor for long, and in the search for a new empress, each of his freedmen ministers backed a different candidate. Narcissus advised remarrying Paetina. Her daughter with Claudius, Claudia Antonia, had married a fine young man named Faustus Cornelius Sulla Felix, a descendant of the original Sulla, who was also a cousin of the central Julio-Claudian dynasty. Narcissus had begun to have his doubts about the worth of Britannicus as an heir and hoped that the older and more experienced Faustus would win the emperor's favor. Callistus, on the other hand, advised marrying Lollia Paulina, an ex-wife of Caligula who he knew from the time they had spent together in the previous emperor's court. You can see that each of the freedmen was backing a different horse, not just because they thought that their preferred candidate would be better for Claudius, but also because they thought that she would be better for them personally. The secretary of the Treasury Pallas, though, would eventually win the argument. He pushed for a union with Agrippina. The Julians and Claudians had been split from the time of the rivalry between Tiberius and Germanicus, and it was time to heal the rift. Plus, Agrippina and her son would always be a rallying point for dissidents as long as they remained outside the dynasty. Co-opt them, and a major threat to Claudius would be instantly eliminated. Claudius was moved by these last points and decided to marry Agrippina on New Year's Day of 48 AD. Now, this decision was not without controversy. We have covered a few marriages so far that would be considered incestual by our standards, but did not raise an eyebrow in ancient Rome. But a man marrying the daughter of his brother? That, my friends, is incest. The people were shocked, scandalized by the news, and they hated it, hated it, hated it. But it was not the scandalous nature of the marriage that was the terrible consequence that Tacitus referred to. Rather, it was what happened once Agrippina got into power. Like Livia before her, she strove with a single-minded purpose to place her own son on the throne. And there is no arguing that Nero becoming emperor was a terrible consequence indeed. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, Episode 63, A Farewell to Claudius. When we left off last time, Claudius was being informed that his cheating wife Messalina had been executed. Though her crime could easily be written off as a mere personal betrayal, when seen from the high vista of imperial politics, infidelity becomes indistinguishable from treason. When the players involved are the emperor and the empress, simple domestic breakdowns quickly become dangerous affairs of state. Messalina's taking of a new husband created a dangerous new power center in opposition to Claudius's existing imperial court. As a result, Messalina and her lover Silius were not allowed to simply go along their merry way and start a new life together, tainted a bit by scandal, but ultimately no worse the wear. No, within days of the revelation of their secret marriage, they were both dead. Silius by suicide, Messalina by execution. A further consequence of the high vista of political power upon which the emperor sat was that there was no time for mourning. The search for a new wife began immediately. But before we get into the details of Claudius's ill-fated marriage to his niece Agrippina and the subsequent rise to power of her son Nero, I want to backtrack a little bit and round out the accomplishments and failures of Claudius's administration, because once Agrippina gets into the picture, dear Claudius will not be long for this world. Perhaps the longest-lasting contribution Claudius made to the empire was the series of territorial annexations he initiated. In addition to the envelopment of southern Britannia, which we have already covered, Claudius's 13 years in power saw the creation of a number of new provinces in regions that had previously existed only as allied client kingdoms. The territories in question were already firmly under Roman control, but Claudius and his freedmen secretariat recognized that the loose, transactional nature of that control was inefficient and ran counter to the centralized, rational administration that they were all working to create. Probably first on the docket, though I can't seem to nail down a definitive date, was the territory of Noricum, which had maintained its autonomy during the Augustan constitutional settlement out of deference for Noricum's support of the Caesars during the various civil wars. This annexation amounted to little more than declaring it so, as Noricum was already fully incorporated into the empire in every other sense of the word. The locals accepted the change with a shrug, and you get the feeling that a few of them might have actually been surprised to learn that they hadn't been a province this whole time. Next up were the territories of Lycia and Pamphylia in southern Anatolia, which were annexed in 43 AD. The region had existed as an independent federation of cities since the time of the Third Macedonian War, but, like I said, it was time to streamline imperial administration. The locals were proud of their independence, but put up no great fight when word came about the reorganization. Finally came the official seizure of Thrace, the wild country between Macedonia and the Hellespont. The independent-minded hill tribes of the region had long fought to maintain independence not just from Rome, but also from each other. And when the Roman-backed but only vaguely recognized client king of, quote, Thrace, was murdered in 46, Claudius decided to just impose Roman order rather than go through another round of intertribal squabbling about who ought to be the next king. These acquisitions all went relatively smoothly, but two additional territories gave the Romans trouble in their consolidation efforts. In the west, Claudius inherited a mess created by Caligula in what would become the two administrative provinces in Mauritania. Back in 40 AD, Caligula decided that he wanted direct control of the region and had invited the client king of the North African territory to Rome for a meeting. As soon as the unsuspecting monarch arrived, though, Caligula had him seized and executed. Immediately, a revolt broke out back in Africa against the Roman officials sent by Caligula to annex the region into the empire. The incident played a part in the decision to assassinate Caligula as senators and officials were appalled by the totally unnecessary destabilization of an otherwise peaceful corner of the empire. When Claudius became emperor, though, he was obliged to follow through on the annexation. Whether or not it was the right thing to do was now irrelevant. Men were up in arms against Rome, and that was unacceptable. Though most of the details have been lost, it seems that it took a few years to put the revolt down before Mauritania too formally joined the empire. In the east, Claudius dealt with the forever maddening province of Judea. The region had been incorporated into the empire in 6 AD by Augustus, but after the good poke-in-the-eye Caligula had given the locals when he tried to have a statue of himself placed in the Temple of Jerusalem, Claudius thought it prudent to grant Judea autonomy under the rule of his friend Herod Agrippa. When Herod Agrippa died 3 years later, according to Christian tradition, smoten by the Lord for the crime of imprisoning the Apostle Peter and executing the Apostle James, control of Judea passed back to Rome. Claudius then handed autonomy back to Herod Agrippa's son in 48 AD in an attempt to maintain some kind of Roman jurisdiction over the notoriously independent Jews who agitated constantly against foreign rule. The relationship between Judea and Rome will remain contentious for years, until finally in 66 AD the so-called Great Revolt will break out, leading to the destruction of Jerusalem and the Jewish diaspora of 70 AD, which we will deal with in more detail later. Taken as a whole, Claudius's reign marks the most active in terms of territorial acquisition we have seen since Augustus and will remain unmatched until Trajan gets the expansionary itch in the early 100s AD. At thehistoryofrome.typepad.com, there is a map of all the provinces brought into the empire during these years. In addition to his geographic reorganizations, Claudius also reorganized the Roman political order. Possibly as a result of all the assassination attempts he dealt with during the early years of his reign, Claudius decided to reintroduce the long-ignored office of censor, which had been left vacant since the days of Augustus. You will recall that in addition to the obvious duty of taking the census, the censor also maintained the senatorial roles and acted as a sort of moral policeman. A censor had the final say over who was in and who was out of the Senate. Once upon a time, this had been meant to ensure that crass and degenerate senators were replaced by more worthy men, but in practice, this function became a political tool used to keep allies and adversaries alike in line. Claudius desperately needed to keep his adversaries and allies in line, so the emperor stepped into the long vacant office in 47 AD and used its authority to do some housekeeping. Claudius purged from the rolls all the families that had been suspected of plotting against him. Suddenly, all the men who had fancied themselves possible candidates for the emperorship due to their senatorial status now found themselves nothing more than mere private citizens without a leg to stand on politically. And, of course, in their place, Claudius brought in men he could trust to be loyal or, at the very least, apathetic towards his administration. Claudius also took his reformation of the Senate one step further by looking out to the provinces for eligible senatorial candidates. Conservative guardians of Italian preeminence were shocked to now find themselves seated alongside barbarian Gauls, who Claudius had determined deserved to be seated due to their long-standing loyalty to Rome and satisfaction of the wealth requirements. It was a move that was hotly debated, but Claudius held firm that the future strength of the empire required Rome to admit the provincials as equal, just as, so long ago, the Latins had been absorbed into Rome, and then, later, the whole of the Italian peninsula. By degrees, the Roman Empire must shed its strictly Roman identity and embrace its multinational character if it's ever going to survive. And in this, Claudius was exactly right. Had the conservatives won the debate and kept the provincials locked out, the Roman Empire likely would have dissolved long before it did. I would also like to mention at this point that Claudius was assisted in all of this by a co-censor named Lucius Vitellius. I only bring this up because Lucius Vitellius' eldest son, Aulus Vitellius Germanicus, is one of the four emperors of the chaotic year of the four emperors that followed the suicide of Nero in 68 AD, and if I do this right, I will have introduced all four of the four emperors by the end of this episode. I've already mentioned Vespasian, the man who will finally emerge victorious from that chaotic year, so that is two down and two to go. The last little episode I want to mention before we get into Agrippina is the ill-fated draining of the Fucine Lake. The idea was to increase the amount of arable land by draining the 140 square kilometer lake in central Italy, which had no natural outlet and was a frequent source of malaria outbreaks. The project was overseen by Narcissus, and over the course of 11 years, workers built 5.5 kilometers of tunnels and canals to reach a natural outlet. In theory, the lake would slowly and steadily disappear, but on the big opening day of the drain pipe, which included speeches, gladiatorial games, and much pomp and circumstance, all that happened was that everyone quickly discovered the tunnel contained too tight a bend, which caused the whole system to back up and wash out the site of all the ceremonies, causing the emperor and all his assembled guests to make a run for it. Not exactly his proudest moment, but in defense of Claudius, he would not be the last man to try and fail to drain the Fucine Lake. It would not be until the 1800s that the feat was finally accomplished by a Swiss engineer. The spectacular failure of the project was an embarrassment for Claudius, but it was an even bigger one for Narcissus. It did not help that Claudius's new wife Agrippina, whose elevation to empress Narcissus had opposed, was using the opportunity afforded by the debacle to accuse Narcissus of embezzlement and incompetence. It didn't really matter whether or not the charges were true, though from everything I know about the man, I actually find it pretty easy to imagine Narcissus skimming a bit off the top. No, what mattered was that Agrippina had her chance to get rid of the troublesome freedman who was allying himself with Claudius' son Britannicus in what was shaping up to be another dynastic struggle between the Julio and Claudian halves of the family. In this struggle, the new empress would prove to be a formidable opponent in the game of power politics. Julia Agrippina, known to us as Agrippina Minor or Agrippina the Younger, was born in November of 15 AD, the eldest daughter of Germanicus and his wife, Agrippina. Named for her mother, Agrippina Minor was carted around the empire by her parents until she wound up settled back in Rome following the death of her father in 19 AD. From that point, she was raised by her mother and then by her great-grandmother, Livia, who, we will see, seems to have had a great influence on the child. In 28 AD, Tiberius ordered the 13-year-old Agrippina to marry the 40-plus-year-old Gnaeus Domitius Ahenobarbus, who was the grandson of Augustus' sister Octavia and Mark Antony. Domitius was apparently something of a cad, though the stories about him are likely exaggerated to help reinforce the despicable nature of his son, Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus, the future Emperor Nero, who Agrippina gave birth to in 37 AD. To avoid confusion, I am going to start calling the boy Nero right now, even though he will remain Lucius until his adoption by Claudius in 50 AD. Nero would wind up being Agrippina's only natural child, as Domitius died of congestive heart failure in January of 40 AD. You'll recall from the episode on Caligula that at first Agrippina and her other sisters were held in exalted status once their brother became emperor. But after the death of Drusilla, the relationship between the remaining siblings seems to have soured. As I mentioned, in 39 AD, Agrippina and her sister Julia Livilla were accused of conspiring against their brother's life with Marcus Aemilius Lepidus, who was A. the widower of Drusilla, B. already tagged by Caligula as a potential heir, and C. apparently the lover of both Agrippina and Julia Livilla. When the plot was exposed, Caligula banished his sisters to a small island in the Tyrrhenian Sea, where legend has it that he forced them to dive for sponges to earn their room and board. At this point, Agrippina had her entire estate confiscated, and her son Nero was stripped of the inheritance left to him by Domitius. Nero himself was carted off to live with a paternal aunt and did not seem a likely candidate to survive childhood. But Agrippina and Nero's fortunes turn when Caligula was assassinated in 41. Claudius recalled the banished sisters, and Agrippina and her son were reunited. The now penniless princess cast about looking for a man with status and wealth necessary to get her back into the lifestyle to which she had grown accustomed. According to Suetonius, she set her sights on the already married General Galba, but was rebuked. Galba, of course, would eventually become the first of the four emperors in the year of four emperors, so, hey, that's three down and one to go. Agrippina got over the rejection and moved on to Gaius Sallistus Crispus Passienus, who Claudius pressured to accept Agrippina's advances. Passienus had already been consul once and would be so again in 44, So his high status returned Agrippina to the center of court life. But the witty and vibrant Passienus fell ill and died in 47 AD, leaving Agrippina widowed once again, though this time she emerged from her bereavement an extremely wealthy woman. This led to her very first accusation of poisoning, which seems to be something of a rite of passage for Julio-Claudian women. When Messalina was executed and the emperor was left a bachelor, the now single Agrippina defied convention and good taste by openly pursuing her uncle as a potential husband. As I said at the end of the last episode, the execution of Messalina led each of Claudius's trusted freedmen to back a different woman for the emperorship. Narcissus backed Claudius's former wife Aelia Paetina, and Callistus backed Lollia Paulina, who had been married to Caligula for about 6 months in 38 AD. Pallas, the Secretary of the Treasury, meanwhile, pushed for Claudius to do the unthinkable. He and Agrippina had become lovers, and if she became empress, well, Pallas figured that he would be set for life. So he argued that the Julio and Claudian wings of the family must be reunited for the dynasty and Rome to survive. Claudius was swayed by these arguments and took the same line to the Senate when he announced his intention to marry his own niece. It was for the good of the empire, Claudius said, and you should treat it as such, and not think too hard about the clear-cut incestual union I'm proposing here. The Senate wasn't very happy about it, but they relented and backed the marriage. The people of Rome, however, were not so understanding and refused to get on board with the program. The marriage would spark a precipitous decline in Claudius's popularity. Agrippina had gone through a number of image makeovers in her life, from pitiable daughter of Germanicus to immoral harlot of Caligula's court to sympathetic exiled mother. With her marriage to Claudius on New Year's Day 49 AD, though, she crystallized into the woman history remembers her as, the ruthlessly ambitious Empress of Rome. Much like Livia before her, Agrippina poured her ambition into the only vessel a woman like her could use to gain and hold power in patriarchal Rome, her son. Even before her marriage to Claudius, Agrippina was hard at work setting Nero up for success. In 48, she had conspired with the aforementioned co-censor Vitellius to smear the fiancé of Claudius's daughter Claudia Octavia to clear the way for Nero to marry into the imperial family. Agrippina succeeded in breaking up the engagement, leading said fiancé to commit suicide along the way, but it would take a few years before she could initiate the marriage between Nero and Claudia. Nero was, after all, only 10 at the time, and Claudia was even younger. But Agrippina could afford to wait, because the next year she managed to pull off the trick of marrying the emperor himself. Agrippina, who had been ping-ponging between relevance and obscurity for years, was now back in power. But she didn't lose sight of the ball, and at once began lobbying Claudius to adopt Nero and make him an heir. In 50, Claudius finally relented and adopted 13-year-old Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus, at which point the boy took the name Nero Claudius Caesar Drusus Germanicus, shortened for our purposes, to Nero. Also following in the footsteps of her great-grandmother Livia, Agrippina convinced Claudius to grant her the title Augusta, and allow her access to special carriages that were generally reserved for priests. These special privileges were outward signs of the influence Agrippina held over her uncle-slash-husband. In a particularly unprecedented display, Claudius actually named a veterans colony he chartered Agrippina Nisium, the only colony in the whole long history of the empire to be named after a woman. But as important as it was to Agrippina that she gather up as much power as she could in the near term, her long-term goal still revolved around her son. The 60-plus-year-old Claudius was nearing the end of his life, while the 35-year-old Agrippina still had a lot of years left. And that meant making sure that her son ascended to the throne when Claudius died. The one obvious obstacle to Agrippina's agenda was Claudius's natural son, 9-year-old Britannicus. Although Nero now had the advantage of technically being Claudius's eldest son, there was no accounting for the favoritism Claudius might be tempted to show his own offspring. So, upon becoming empress, Agrippina scrubbed the imperial palace of anyone who had been connected to Messalina and who might be tempted to advance Britannicus's interests. When Claudius cast about for advice on what to do about the issue of succession, Agrippina wanted to make sure that the only people around to speak up would be those firmly in her corner. She went so far as to have Britannicus's tutor killed when he raised too much of a stink about his pupil being neglected by the emperor. Unfortunately for Agrippina, the man who emerged as one of Britannicus's greatest advocates was one of the few men she could not simply dispose of on a whim, Narcissus. The freedman had his doubts about Britannicus, but those paled in comparison to his doubts about Nero. The boy was shaping up to be petulant, selfish, and vain. When Narcissus looked at Nero, he saw the second coming of Caligula. Agrippina worked hard to try to box Narcissus out, and as I said, she went after him hard over the Fucine Lake debacle. But the freedman was tied too deeply to the emperor. Try as she might, Agrippina could not dislodge Narcissus from Claudius's ear. But despite that, as was usually the case during these years, Agrippina finally did get her way, at least partially. And in 51 AD, 14-year-old Nero was elevated to manhood and named as a co-heir alongside the still underage Britannicus. In theory, they were meant to rule together when the time came, but in practice, the timing of Claudius's declaration opened a window of a few years where Nero was now a man and able to assume the duties of state, while Britannicus was still legally a child. For all intents and purposes, Nero, right now, was the sole heir. Agrippina would not fail to miss the significance of this development. In 53 AD, Nero's position was strengthened even more by a marriage to his now stepsister Claudia Octavia. The public was starting to get behind the idea that this grandson of Germanicus was destined to be their next emperor. But just as everything seemed to be going Agrippina's way, Claudius began to regret having given so much to Nero at the expense of his own son. Whether Narcissus was behind the change of heart, or whether the emperor himself came to his own conclusions is unknown. But at some point in 54 AD, Claudius began to look at Britannicus more and more as his rightful heir. Agrippina sensed that the winds were beginning to blow against her and recognized that she might be facing a pretty clear deadline. Britannicus would soon be coming of age, and once he was a legal adult, Claudius was making noise about no longer than needing his manipulative wife and her spoiled teenage son. With Britannicus slated to take the rights of manhood in just 6 months, Agrippina had no time to spare. She was too close to fulfilling her dreams to let it all just slip away. Now, I am sort of going with the story here that Agrippina did indeed poison Claudius in October of 54. But it should be noted that though the ancient sources all agree that she did it, there was never any firm evidence they could point to prove their case. The accusation is based on supposition and probability, coupled with the old wicked stepmother motif that runs through all of Roman culture. Basically, Agrippina had the means, motive, and opportunity, and her character points to her acting on all three. The most common version of the story is that Agrippina conspired with Claudius's taster to slip the emperor a few poisoned mushrooms, though his doctor was also fingered as a possible culprit. Whether it really was poison, which I happen to believe, or whether it was just nature taking its course, Claudius became violently ill and died on October 13, 54 AD. He was 64 years old and had ruled the empire for 13 fairly successful years. The life and career of Claudius has to be one of the more unique in all of history. Good men and bad men, ambitious men and unassuming men, wise men and dumb men have all taken their turns in power, but all wind up conforming to some kind of recognizable archetype. But I can't really think of anyone who quite resembles Claudius, the accidental emperor. The guy was a punchline for his whole life. I doubt there could have been lower expectations when it was announced that Uncle Claudius was now in charge. But not only did he clear the minimal bar that had been set for him, but he was far and away the best emperor since Augustus himself. Now, I know that isn't saying very much, as between the purges of Tiberius and, well, the everything of Caligula, it doesn't take a whole lot to earn the title best emperor since Augustus. But when you think about the image most Romans had in their heads of Claudius, the slow-witted, stuttering dunce, you have to admit that it's impressive how out of nowhere he came to claim that prize. And the thing is, if you rank all the emperors, past, present, and future, which is a list of somewhere around 100 men, depending on who's counting, I think Claudius pretty comfortably sits in the top 10. He's not a great emperor like Augustus or Constantine or Diocletian, and he probably sits behind the so-called five good emperors in terms of impact and talent, but yeah, Claudius is in the top 10. I'm going to miss him. Next week, we'll get into one of the bottom feeders, who is constantly duking it out with Caligula and Elagabalus and Commodus for the title of worst emperor ever. Though I think Nero was pretty clearly not as bad as Caligula, and his leisure pursuits were far less insane, he was still pretty awful. The problem with Nero is that he didn't seem to have much interest in actually being emperor. He wanted to play gladiator and sing songs and compete in games. To him, the best part of being emperor is that everyone lets you win at everything. In his defense, Nero was only 16 years old when he ascended to the throne, which explains a great deal of his immaturity. But still, at a certain point, you've got to look yourself in the mirror and want to be a better person. If not for yourself, then for the people who are counting on you to do a good job. Because if you don't have that moment and you just stay the same immature kid your whole life, well, eventually you wind up committing a panicked suicide after your enemies have launched a successful coup d'etat. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, Episode 64, Smite My Womb. Before we get into this week's episode, I just want to say thank you for all the condolences that were attached to last week's sad announcement of my grandfather's death. A confirmed history buff, I know he enjoyed listening to the History of Rome, even if Dad did have to burn it onto CDs for him because, you know, iTunes is what again? The first time I ever read any part of Gibbon's Decline and Fall was from Grandpa's three-volume set that still sits on the bookshelf in their living room. I look at those books every time I go out to visit and remember fondly being 15 years old and just sitting there, absorbed in the story of Rome with the chaos of a family Christmas swirling around me. Eventually, we'll get into that phase of the Empire where I'll be drawing heavily from Gibbon, and we'll need to reread everything, and though I now have my own set, the words will still be the same ones I read in Grandpa's old paperbacks, and I won't be able to help but be transported back to that time and place and think of Grandpa and thank him for just being the kind of guy who would have a three-volume set of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire sitting front and center in his living room when a bookless grandson needed something to read to pass the time. The other thing I want to say before we get going is that last time I had this whole joke set up where I finally get around to introducing Otho, the last of the four emperors from the year of the four emperors, and I was going to do it in this really forced way during my closing remarks because, unlike the other three, he was pretty much not around during the last years of Claudius's reign. It was going to be like, oh, and Otho was also alive. There, I covered them all. But, well, it was over 100 degrees in Portland for like 2 weeks straight, and I'm writing in this second-story apartment with no air conditioning, and yeah, I sort of lost track of what I was doing. So if it seemed really weird when you listened to the last episode that I would make a point of saying I'm going to introduce them all and then, you know, didn't, there's really no explanation for it other than I was hot and fumbled the ball. Oh well. So, okay, on with the show. One of the reasons so many people assume that Agrippina engineered the assassination of her husband/uncle Claudius was because of what happened in the immediate aftermath of his death. The speed with which Nero was confirmed as the new emperor, the speed with which Claudius's will was suppressed to lock Britannicus out of his inheritance, and the speed with which Agrippina was granted her own independent powers just screamed foul play. Plus, just before Claudius died, Agrippina had sent Narcissus out of town on business, removing the one man who could plausibly raise an effective opposition to Agrippina and her son should something unfortunate happen to the emperor and succession became an issue. Narcissus, as I've mentioned, supported Britannicus as the lesser of two evils when it came to succession. With Claudius dead and no Narcissus around to get in her way, Agrippina was able to literally lock up Britannicus and his sisters in the palace and keep them there while she marched Nero out alone in front of the guard, where they were ordered by the Praetorian prefect, Sextus Sophronius Burrus, to hail the teenager as the new leader of Rome. Some question the absence of Britannicus from these proceedings, but without any pushback from anyone with real authority, like, say, Narcissus, they simply shrugged their shoulders and went along with it. After a hastily called session of the Senate confirmed what the Praetorian Guard had already declared, 16-year-old Nero became the fifth emperor of Rome. As with Caligula, the people greeted the announcement with a great deal of optimism. Transition of power are always fraught with danger, but this one seemed to come and go easily, and with young Nero now in power and no doubt destined for a long and full life, entire generations might be able to live and die without ever having to worry about the horror of a civil war sparked by competing claimants to the throne. It could be 50 years or more before the issue would even come up again. That kind of stability is precious. Plus, Nero was the grandson of Germanicus and, a true Julian, directly descended from Augustus himself. Truly, the gods were smiling on Rome when they raised the boy up to command the empire. But to those who had actually worked behind the scenes to make sure Nero was elevated, it was not the will of the gods that the boy himself command the empire. More like it was the will of the gods that Nero be a conduit through which they would command the empire. Agrippina especially did not see her son's rise as anything other than a means to her own ends. And in securing her own ends, she went even further than Livia had when Tiberius finally came to power. Immediately after Claudius died, the Senate obliged her calls to raise the dead emperor to divine status within the growing imperial pantheon. To head the new cult of the divine Claudius, the Senate declared that they could think of no one better than his virtuous widow, Agrippina. Granted two attendants to accompany her in public, Agrippina now had an outward display of the power she had been acquiring behind the scenes, which now included a literal behind-the-scenes component, as the empress was allowed to now attend meetings of the Senate as long as she remained behind a curtain. In the months after Claudius died, Agrippina was at the height of her power, and Nero was indeed little more than a conduit for the will of his mother. But it was not just his mother who held sway over the boy. Though Narcissus was of course destined to turn up murdered just months after Nero came to power, his fellow freedman secretary Pallas still remained ensconced as the head of the imperial treasury and did not so much consult the new emperor as report what he had already done. This would lead to trouble for Pallas down the road, as would his close connection to Agrippina, but for now he was even stronger politically than he had been under Claudius. The other two major players in the early years of Nero's reign were the Praetorian prefect Burrus and the tutor Claudius had brought in to educate his adopted son, Lucius Annius Seneca, who, beyond his political role as tutor and advisor to Nero, is a major figure in the Western philosophical canon, not so much for the originality of his ideas, but for the role he played in articulating and translating the Stoic philosophy into comprehensible language. His role in Western philosophy, then, is much like Cicero's, as a compiler and articulator of ideas that had already been established elsewhere. His influence is magnified by the fact that later Christian writers seemed to embrace him, and so his work continued to be copied and saved rather than suppressed or destroyed, a fate which befell most of his contemporaries. But for this period, Seneca's role as advisor and teacher of Nero is what he was most well known for. It probably doesn't even need to be said that with all these various advisors coming at Nero from different angles, a mother, a captain of the guard, a philosopher, and a treasurer, that there would be conflict between them. Pretty soon, they broke into two broad camps, with Agrippina and her lover Pallas on one side, and Burrus and Seneca on the other. I think it would be too simplified to say that one side pushed Agrippina's personal interests, while the other side pushed for Nero to consider the good of the whole empire when making decisions, but that is sort of how things shook out. One telling scene played out when Nero was to greet the ambassadors arriving from Armenia. To the horror of Burrus and Seneca, Agrippina seated herself next to Nero,
a scandalous move in the patriarchal ancient world that would have reflected terribly on Rome. At the last minute, they hustled her out the door, narrowly avoiding what they were convinced would have been a huge diplomatic blunder.
Unfortunately for Agrippina, from very early on, this seemed to be the way things played out. Her visions of ruling Rome through Nero were smacking into the wall of reality, because in reality, I don't know if you know this, but 16-year-olds do not like to be told what to do by their mothers. So Nero quickly drifted out of Agrippina's orbit. In early 55, things came to a head over, you guessed it, a girl. Specifically, an ex-slave girl named Claudia Acte. Dissatisfied with his politically useful marriage to Claudia Octavia, Nero fell head over heels in love with Claudia Acte and took her as his mistress. Agrippina was enraged that her noble patrician son was cavorting about with some ex-slave girl and tried to forbid Nero from seeing her. But, as is so often the case, this only heightened the appeal for Nero, and instead of shutting out Claudia Acte, he shut out his mother. Seneca and others close to Nero encouraged him to keep his mistress while they played a tricky game to both keep the affair secret from some people and publicize it to others. Because on the one hand, it really was important to maintain his marriage with Claudia Octavia, but on the other hand, there were some pretty harsh rumors going around about Nero and the true nature of his relationship with his mother that they wanted to quash. As you can imagine, after taking her own uncle as a husband, it did not take long for people to imply things about what was really going on between mother and son. There is no evidence that any of it was true, but the charge was out there, and so, for it to be known in whispered corners that Nero had taken a freedwoman as a consort over the strenuous objections of Agrippina was definitely useful politically. So suddenly, Agrippina was on the outs. Right at the moment she thought the whole empire was in her grasp, her ungrateful son was trying to take it all away from her. Undeterred, though, Agrippina showed her true colors once again, that it never had been about elevating her son for his own sake, but rather for her own sake. So in the Politics Makes Strange Bedfellows department, Agrippina began calling on Britannicus and hinting that he had as much right to the throne as Nero. Less than a year after depriving him of his inheritance, Agrippina suddenly became Britannicus's strongest advocate. The tension between mother and son grew when Nero decided to dismiss Pallas from his role as Secretary of the Treasury. As one of the last allies within the inner circle of power, the dismissal of Pallas was unacceptable to Agrippina. She promised Nero that if he continued to ignore her, that she would go to the Praetorians with Britannicus as soon as the boy came of age, and reveal her own part in the death of Claudius, whereupon the guard would reject the usurper Nero in favor of the true heir, Britannicus. But in this, I think Agrippina badly misplayed her hand. Whether she was simply using Britannicus as leverage to force her way back into a position of influence, or whether she had determined her relationship with Nero was irreconcilable and was actually planning to help Britannicus gain the throne, her decision to wave these threats around before Britannicus came of age was a tactical blunder. Had she waited the few months for Britannicus to come of age, she could have then threatened to take the young man to the Praetorians right this very second, if you don't give me what I want. Instead, she telegraphed her moves too early, giving Nero a chance to nullify the threat before it actually became a problem. Not surprisingly, on the day before he was to don an adult's toga, Britannicus was invited to dinner at the Imperial Palace. His drink was poison, and, foaming at the mouth, he died right there on the spot. What did Agrippina think was going to happen? At this point, though Agrippina remained popular with the people and maintained her own informal network of clients, her dreams of ruling Rome through her son were dead. At some point, either in 55 or 57 AD, Nero ordered her to leave the imperial palace, and she was forced to retire to a villa outside of Rome. But Agrippina was not the only one to be cast aside by this teenager who was slowly coming to realize that he was the emperor, not the cunning advisors who swirled around him. When Pallas was dismissed, he was accused of conspiring to bring Faustus Sulla, the husband of Claudia Antonia and the man who Narcissus had once seen as the best candidate to succeed Claudius, to the throne. The Praetorian prefect Burrus was caught up with similar charges, and Seneca was suddenly accused of embezzlement and maintaining a relationship with Agrippina. Through the influence of Seneca, all three men were ultimately cleared of the charges, but almost in a flash, the ruling dynamic had changed. Burrus and Seneca returned to their positions within the administration, but in the future, they treaded far more lightly than they had in the past. Nero had clearly decided that he was his own man. So who was this man? Up until now, he's been little more than a supporting character.
his own personality almost invisible behind the dominating presence of his mother and his other advisors. If he is now going to start acting more on his own impulses, following his own desires and whims, it will probably be helpful for us to know what motivated the young emperor. Right up front, the obvious thing to note is his age. Nero ascended to the throne when he was barely 16 years old. And I don't know about you guys, but when I think of myself at 16, let's just say I think it's crazy anyone even trusted me with a driver's license. Now, of course, being so young doesn't necessarily preclude sound judgment. Augustus himself was not so much older when he began his meteoric rise, and Scipio Africanus scoffed at the age requirements on his way to defeating Hannibal and bringing an end to the Second Punic War. But both Augustus and Scipio, despite their youth, had already been tempered by experience. Julius Caesar brought Octavian early into his administration to teach the boy how to govern, and Scipio had served alongside his father during the early disastrous campaigns against the invading Carthaginians. Nero, in addition to his youth, had no such experience to fall back on. He had fought no battles, and despite serving as a proconsul at the end of Claudius's reign, little had been expected of him, and he had delivered. Perhaps the greatest distinction that can be drawn between young Nero and young Augustus or young Scipio is that the latter two were driven by an ambition to hold power and use that power to shape the world in which they lived. They understood how to use propaganda to achieve the level of popularity needed to wield the power they sought, but to them, popularity was a means to an end. For Nero, popularity would prove to be an end unto itself. Over the course of his reign, some of his policies can be described as good, others as terrible debacles, some as compassionate, others as unimaginably cruel. But almost without exception, they were all undertaken not in pursuit of some greater vision of the betterment of Rome, but rather because Nero was desperately seeking the approval of his people. And while all politicians have to keep one eye on the polls, whether they admit it or not, no truly successful politician has ever simply followed the lurching desires of the public wherever that may lead. Because the public is an irrational, self-interested, short-sighted blob of contradictions, and at a certain point, the successful leader has to identify what he or she wants to do, what he or she thinks is necessary to do, and then just do it. Actually be a leader, not just a follower. I don't think Nero ever did grasp this idea, nor does it appear that he ever really tried to grasp that idea. Though it is worth noting that Nero was pretty successful at being popular, which is the metric by which at least he measured himself. After he died, huge swaths of the public, especially the poor masses, mourned his death and pined for a return of their beloved young Nero. So he never became the out-and-out pariah that Caligula turned out to be, which is why Nero, for all his faults, will not go down as the worst emperor ever. While his underlying governing philosophy was fundamentally flawed, the results were in no way uniformly terrible. One of the reasons, though, that he has received such a bad rap is that while the poor masses may have loved him for all the games he threw, the programs he expanded, and the taxes that he slashed, the wealthy upper classes, the senators and equites, couldn't stand him. To them, Nero was an embarrassment, an honorless hedonist whose very existence was an affront to the memory of a Rome once proud of its virtuous character. And guess who has the leisure time to write the history books that we read today? That's right, the very same wealthy aristocrats who couldn't stand the insufferable punk to begin with. Now, it should also be pointed out that Nero has a very bad reputation today also because of his zealous persecution of early Christians. And as most of us now live under the umbrella of Christian civilization, it is no great wonder that a man who was so cruel to the early church will wind up being portrayed in the most negative light possible. But I don't want to lose track of where I'm going with this, and I'll return to the topic of Nero's relationship with early Christians later, because right now I want to pivot into why the aristocratic classes saw Nero as such an embarrassment, and why, despite the fact that from very early on he tried to give the Senate more autonomy, they never did support him. In the Roman world, there were things you could do that would be considered good and virtuous, and things you could do that would be considered beneath the dignity of a leading Roman citizen. In the former camp, you have things that we've already discussed at length, serving in the legions, winning battles, holding public office, delivering articulate and persuasive orations. In the latter camp, well, there are many things you're not supposed to do, but what I want to specifically highlight right now is the Roman antipathy towards the entertainment industry, and hopefully convey just how big of a deal it was that Nero just wanted to dance. Today, of course, actors, athletes, and musicians sit on the highest rung of the social ladder. But in the Roman world, this was reversed. Actors, dancers, gladiators, and musicians were the lowest of the low. It was practically better to be a slave than to be an entertainer. Not that Romans didn't enjoy their theater and their gladiatorial games, just that when the performance was over, the stars of the show who you've just been applauding wildly are shunted off into the deepest recesses of the worst ghettos. Being an entertainer in ancient Rome was to be an untouchable, and it was unthinkable that a patrician in good standing would ever risk his reputation by ever being seen in public with an actor, let alone perform on the stage himself. Side note, patricians in good standing, as aristocrats of every age have done, slummed it up regularly with actors and gladiators alike, so it was really unthinkable in that kind of no one ever likes to talk about what everyone is doing sort of way. Anyway, along comes Nero. He has never served in the legions, he has never won a battle, he had barely scratched the surface of a public career before becoming emperor, and it was widely known that he did not even write his own speeches, a sad state of affairs that not even Caligula had been reduced to. None of these virtuous Roman ideals seemed to get Nero's motor running. Instead, he obsessively practiced his lyre, the small harp popular in the Greco-Roman world, and he talked often of joining in the gladiatorial games where he dreamed of becoming a great charioteer. It would be a few years before he had the courage to pursue these dreams, but from the beginning, it was clear that Nero cared more about performing his music than he did about major affairs of state. If you called on the emperor, you were as likely to wind up being forced to sit through his new set as you were to discuss the provincial tax policies you had actually come to discuss. It cannot be understated how much this bugged the conservative upper classes. Adding to their distaste for Nero was the fact that, beyond his embarrassing hobbies, the emperor clearly had a cruel streak, and that that cruel streak was often directed at nobles whom he considered a threat. From the very beginning, anyone considered an enemy of the new emperor was charged with treason and executed. The bloodshed would reach its peak in 62 and 63 AD, when the killing became more indiscriminate. With everyone afraid that they might be next, a major conspiracy to overthrow Nero was initiated in response, but it was discovered in 65 AD, and dozens of men, including at this point Seneca, were swallowed up in the post-conspiracy purges. But perhaps the greatest example of Nero's cruelty was the fate of his own mother. After years spent estranged from her son, Agrippina once again popped up on Nero's radar in 58 AD, and the emperor came to the conclusion that he wanted to eliminate this blip once and for all. The traditional account is that having never been happy with his marriage to Claudia Octavia, Nero took up with a woman named Poppaea Sabina, the wife of Otho, future year of the four emperors Otho. Nero wanted to marry her, but Agrippina promised to raise holy hell if he abandoned his politically valuable marriage with Claudia Octavia. Having had quite enough of this, Nero believed that he would never be free of his mother until she was dead, so he decided to have her killed. It has been pointed out that there are chronological problems with this account, though, that while Agrippina was killed in 59, Nero did not marry Poppaea until 3 years later, so the link between the two events seems dicey at best, and probably reflects an echo effect of the earlier incident with Claudia Acte. Others have argued that it was Agrippina's apparent support for one of Nero's cousins, Gaius Rubellius Plautus, that finally did her in. This claim, which echoes the incident with Britannicus, seems to be more plausible, as it represented a clear political threat to Nero, rather than just more insufferable meddling from his overbearing mother. Whatever the cause, Nero set himself upon a course of matricide. According to the ancient sources, though, things did not exactly come off without a hitch. Depending on who you listen to, Nero tried and failed 3 times to have her poisoned, tried once to rig the ceiling above her bed to collapse while she slept, and once succeeded in shipwrecking a boat she was on, only to find out later that she had swum to safety.
In the end, he abandoned his attempt to frame her death as an accident and sent an assassin to simply stab her to death. This time, the attempt was successful. According to legend, her last words were, "Smite my womb." But as they say, you can't really close the barn door after the horses have already taken off. Nero announced that his mother had been discovered plotting against his life, and that in response to the discovery, she had committed suicide. No one believed it, of course, but that's what the official story was. The unofficial story was that for years afterwards, Nero was racked with guilt and believed that he was being haunted by the ghost of his murdered mother. Next week, we'll delve into the eventful years of Nero's reign after the death of Agrippina. The 60s AD proved to be a turbulent time for Rome, as revolts broke out in Judea and Britannia, and the Parthian Empire decided to take advantage of the young and inexperienced emperor of Rome by encroaching on the Roman borders in the east. And this is to say nothing of the great fire that devastated Rome itself in 65 AD, through which Nero is famously said to have fiddled his way through. But we all know now that this story could not possibly be true, because Nero did not play the fiddle. He played the lyre.